My name is Dylan Alcott. This is Triple J. I am filling in for Zan Rowe, who's currently on leave. And I tell you what, I'm very excited because I've been a Triple J fan before I started working here. And one of my favourite segments was Science Hour with Dr. Carl. And I am joined in studio right now by the man himself, Dr. Carl. How are you doing?
Look, I'm very honoured by what you said, and I'm not worthy because you do so much more than me. Let's just start up a mutual admiration society and ignore the audience.
Oh, Dr. Carl, I didn't think this would ever happen. I used to listen all the time. Now I'm getting to host it with you. Mate, it's an absolute privilege and an honour, and I'm looking forward to the next hour.
Okay, let's see what the callers have got for us.
Beautiful. Today. We'll start with Shane in Nowra. What's your question, Shane?
Hey, how you going? I was wondering, is the Earth gaining or losing mass, and what would be the long-term effect of this?
It's losing 50,000 tons of gas every year, mainly hydrogen and helium, and then a few of the lighter other ones as well. But it's gaining 90,000 tons every year from meteors falling on the Earth. So overall, the Earth is gaining mass at about 40,000 tons per year. Now, this is not going to make any difference to our orbital status because with regard to going around the sun, as we do, at about 140 million kilometres out and travelling at 30 kilometres a second, it does not matter whether we weigh 1 gram or a trillion grams. So it's not going to change anything in the short term, although over the long term, the gravitational field will increase just so small that only people like NASA will have to worry about it when they do gravitational slingshots, but that'll be probably in a million years or a billion years. So in the short term, it's not going to make any difference. Is that kind of answering your question?
Yeah, pretty much.
Cool. Thanks.
Pretty much. Not much is going to happen. We will never really.
Not in the short term. No. But we are redistributing mass on the Earth. So, for example, we're melting 600 billion tons of ice every year, and it's shifting from the Arctic and Antarctic regions towards the equator, and that's caused the Earth to change its tilt by a tiny, tiny amount. No big deal. But the global warming, that's a different thing.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Good on you, Shane. Thanks for that. We've now got Hannah in Geelong. What's your question, Hannah?
Thank you, Shane.
Hello.
G'day, Hannah. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Hi, Hannah.
Hi, I was just wondering, I'm allergic to cooked mushrooms, but not raw. Like, I've tried cooking it in heaps of different things, but I don't know what changes, and it just makes my lips swell up so much when I eat cooked mushrooms.
Ah, there is something lovely about cooked mushrooms, but there's something even lovelier about raw mushrooms. And in general, practically all allergies are due to proteins.
Okay.
So you might find that... Okay, let me just rephrase that. There's one allergy that we do know of that is due to carbohydrates, and that's the meat allergy called alpha-gal, and people can then get bitten by a tick and then a couple of months later find themselves allergic to certain types of meat for the rest of their lives. But in general, it's the proteins, and almost certainly by cooking them, you're breaking down and changing the proteins, so there's a difference between the raw and the cooked mushrooms. So one will set off your allergies and one won't. So it just means that you're slightly limited with your foods, but on the other hand, you don't have to worry about getting an EpiPen and being allergic and trying to die when you have the wrong sort of mushroom.
What determines what things you are allergic to and what you aren't allergic to in terms of our bodies?
Evolution on the long term. And so we have reactions against things that are definitely harmful to us. So your body, for example, will recognise a hepatitis virus as being bad and sort of set off a certain type of immune reaction. But sometimes it protects you against things that you don't need to be protected against. And your classic case is your pollen and hay fever. Mm. So there are chemicals similar to them that can be bad for you. And in most of us, it says, it's different, don't worry about it. But in a small percentage of people, they see the pollen come in and the immune system says, oh, this is bad. And so they're suffering more from their own reaction than they would if they just let the pollen come in and out of their system.
Cool. All right. Thanks for that, Hannah. We've got Connor in Toowoomba. What's your question, Connor?
Hey, guys. My question is, if the sun was to blow up right now, would we see it? How long would the delay be? And what would kill us first?
Whoa. Okay. There would be a delay. So if the sun were to either be stolen by the aliens or blown up right now, we would find out about it in 8 minutes, and then it depends on what sort of blowing up you mean. So if it goes into a nova or supernova, which it really can't do because it's not heavy enough, we'd get killed by all sorts of radiation, such as gamma rays. If you do want to worry about what can actually really kill us in terms of stuff blowing up, you got a pen and paper, Connor? Can you write this down?
Oh, I can right now. Just give me a second.
WR101. Yeah, WR101, and that's a star that's not too far away from us, and if it blows up, it's heavy enough to put out bad radiation, whereas our sun's not on that pathway. This one is, because it's heavier on that pathway, and it's getting near the end of the days, and if it happens to blow up when it's in the right orientation, because it's wobbling, it will throw a beam of radiation at us that on the side of the Earth, facing WR101... we'll lose all the ozone and suddenly things will get really, really messy and there'll be mass wipeouts on Earth. So look up WR101 if you want to have a nice bit of, oh, my God, what'll happen? The universe is a dangerous place.
Cool. Good on you, Connor. Thanks for that, mate. Got more questions
about
Dr. Carl coming up after this. It's Lisa Mitchell with Corn Laundry on Triple J. Hey, we've got Tom from Mount Gambier here. What's your question, Tom?
Yeah, g'day. Just wondering... you know how, like, whenever somebody like runs their fingernails down a chalkboard, you cringe. Well, I get that whenever people brush their teeth, or if I watch somebody brush their teeth. I was wondering why that is.
Ah, there's a new disorder that you might have, which is so new it doesn't appear in the DSM-5 or medical textbooks or even many dictionaries. It's called misophonia, misophonia. And it's where people are abnormally sensitive to some sounds and then the reaction is really nasty. I'll give you the website, soundsensitivity.info. Soundsensitivity.info. And yep. So what happens when you're hearing, for most people is a normal benign sound, and for the people who suffer from misophonia, 80% of these sounds come from the mouth and nose, and about 60% have a strong repetitive element. And so these trigger sounds can include hand noises such as typing or clicking a pen or eating or chewing or footsteps or breathing or yawning or even a cat licking its paws or even the plosive sound of the letter P, as in Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. And the reaction of the person is an extremely emotional and bizarre and extreme combination of rage, terror, fear, panic, and anger. In 5% of cases, they have no control and it leads to physical violence. In 25%, verbal violence, where they start shouting. And in most cases, 3/4, they can sort of bottle it up, but it interferes with their daily regular work, making new friends, interacting with friends. Here's a typical one from a 41-year-old mother of two. So the daughter was eating carrots and she tried, they were noisy carrots, and she was trying not to react. And so there was deep breathing and pacing, and I had an elevated heart rate, extreme anxiety. I started grabbing my own hair, and I was shaky, and my head was full of noise. I was overwhelmed. My body and mind had taken over. And then the mother says to a cute little two-year-old daughter, I started roaring at her, swearing, and I had no control. So look up the soundsensitivity.info website, and it's so new, it's not officially a disease. And then armed with that, go and see your GP. There are some things that work. Cognitive behavior therapy and some sort of brain training can have a success rate as high as 83%. And there's a homepage story I've written about it. So if you just go to ABC and Dr. Carl and look up the story, misophonia.
Good on you, Tom. Thanks for your call, mate.
It's fantastic. Thank you.
Good on you. Now we've got Mesa in Sydney. What's your question, Mesa?
Hello, doctors. How are you?
I'm well, Mesa. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. My question was, why do we scream when we are in pain?
Right. Two kind of answers there. The first one is to protect the group. Evolutionary biology, I've just stood on a scorpion or had my leg ripped off by a killer kangaroo. By screaming, I warn everybody else in the group that there's scorpions or kangaroos. The second one is selfish. If, when you have pain, you specifically say swear words, the pain is less. Now, I'm not saying that every time you hit your thumb and you happen to be near a primary school, you should start shouting out swear words, but the actual shouting reduces your own pain, and if you say really bad words, it reduces a bit more, but that's not telling you to go and swear in front of little kids.
Definitely not on the radio.
Okay, thank you.
Cool. Good on you, Mesa. Thanks for your question. We've now got Jared in Canberra. Jared, what's your question for Dr. Carl?
Morning, doctors.
G'day, Dr. Jared. How are you, mate?
Good, thanks. I heard that the Earth's magnetic poles are due to swap around. I was just wondering if that's true, and if it is, what effect will that have on us?
So go looking up magnetic field reversal on our good friend Wikipedia. And the situation is that the magnetic fields have always flipped over a long period of time, and they do it at fairly regular intervals. And yes, we are overdue for another magnetic field reversal. Oh my God, what's happening? So during the period that we have no magnetic field at all, then the Earth's atmosphere begins to get stripped off the planet by the solar wind, which is pumping out of the sun at around 1 million tonnes per second. In the case of the planet Mars, it cooled down a long time ago. Its iron core cooled down a long time ago. It lost its magnetic field a long time ago, and as a result, the solar wind stripped away its atmosphere. So the two effects that would happen to the Earth if we lose our magnetic field would be, firstly, we would find that there'd be a bit of a loss of the atmosphere, but not much, because it'd only be a short period of time. Secondly, you'd have really nice auroras coming all the way practically to the equator. But thirdly, I threw in a third one, there'd be an increase in the mutation rate due to the extra radiation, and so some of those mutations would be good for humans and some would be bad. Either way, they would just happen because we're just small stuff in the big play of the universe.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Good on you, Dr. Jared. Thanks, mate. We've got a question from Taylor in New South Wales. Taylor, what's your question?
Hello. I was just wondering if it was possible for a person with brown eyes and a person with blue eyes to make a green-eyed baby.
Yes. So firstly, the colour of your iris is not due to a blue dye or a green dye or a brown dye, but rather just one dye called melanin, and the more of it you have, the darker the colour. So if you have low quantities, it's blue, and then as you lay down during life, more of this dye, then you end up with green and then you go up to brown. So, and that's all following Rayleigh's law of scattering, which is what is involved with the sky being blue. That's the first thing. The second thing is that what we were all taught at school about the genetics of eye colour is so simple that it's wrong. And it used to be told that this colour plus that colour will only give you the other colour. No way. So it's far more complicated, and so it is possible. Not common, but it definitely is possible under the what we know about genetics today. Does that help, Dr. Taylor?
Yes, that helped a lot because, in school you learn that it isn't possible. But my partner has green eyes and his parents have blue and brown eyes. So I was always believed that it wasn't possible. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about science. It is self-correcting. We find that we've made a mistake and then we let people know about it rather than just trying to cover it up.
Good on you, Taylor. Okay. Thanks for your question. No worries at all.
Bye.
We're now going to Matt in Queensland. Hey, Matt, what's your question?
Hey, mate. I was just wondering, you know how the world's flat? No, just joking. in an aeroplane, if you go up to cruising altitude, and you're up there for however long, and you get up out of your seat and you head towards the cockpit to go to the toilet or whatever, and then you walk backwards, are you using more force to head towards the cockpit than you are against, or is it equal because it's pressurized?
It's nothing to do with the pressure. It's a very deep question. It was first raised by Galileo, and he was a bit of a genius, and only solved about four centuries later because it was such a hard problem by Einstein. And so the bottom line is this, that if you are at a constant velocity, it's exactly the same as being perfectly stationary. And the way it began was that Galileo happened to be on a boat in a harbour below decks in Naples, and it was a very calm day with no wind, and he was just sitting there dead quiet, the boat wasn't rocking at all. And a little wind, a tiny wind picked up, and he started to move slowly, but he didn't know it. And then he looked out the window from below the decks, and he suddenly saw that they were moving, but he had no idea that they were moving, and he suddenly realized that there's no difference. So go looking up inertial frame of reference, I-N-E-R-T-I-A-L, frame of reference. And I did the fun thing on the fast train in China, in Shanghai. When it gets up to about 400 kilometres per hour, you get to the front of the cabin and then you jump into the air and you're hoping, gee, I hope the laws of physics still apply and I don't end up flying down the aisle of the plane, of this train at 400 kilometres an hour and ending up as a thin layer of chunky red saucer on the back end of the train, and it doesn't happen. You land exactly where you come from. So it's not the pressure, it's the concept of frame of reference. It's a deep thing you've asked there, Dr. Matt.
Yeah, I understand that, Carl, but, like, are you telling me if Usain Bolt was on an airplane, he'd be able to sprint, an empty airplane, he'd be able to sprint towards the cockpit at the same speed as taking back? Because every time I get up to go towards the front of the plane, it always seems like it's harder, and if I was to jog back, I could do it twice as quick. Like, I know as you jump up, you're going to land in the same spot, but just that force against you, you can sort of feel it the whole time you're flying.
Ah, you just suddenly opened my mind to something I just remembered the other day from a pilot. The planes fly not dead flat, but slightly tilted up at the nose. Only by about 2 or 3 degrees, and that's just to give them a bit of extra lift for free. And so you're dead right. It is slightly harder going up the hill than down the hill. I completely forgot about that. Thank you very much, Dr. Matt, for reminding me.
That's right. I'm a veterinarian.
Good on you, Matt. Thanks for your question, mate. We're now joined by Dante in New South Wales. How you doing, Dante?
Good.
How old are you, Dante?
10 turning 11.
10 turning 11, starting your science understanding very early, mate. I love it. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
What would happen if something surpassed the speed of light?
The conventional knowledge, theories, etc., told to us by Einstein, which have never been disproven, are that you cannot get to the speed of light exactly. You can get close to it, but you can't actually get there. But other people have done the mathematics of going faster than the speed of light, and in general, it's all contradictory, but one result that does possibly turn up in some cases is that you accidentally invent a time machine and go back in time. Now, that's one thing of going faster than the speed of light. Now, the second thing with regard to going faster than the speed of light of, are you thinking of travelling somewhere? And in that case, if you want to travel, say, to the distant stars, you need to be able to go faster than the speed of light. Can't do it, but what you can do is grab the fabric of space-time and shrink it in front of you and expand it behind you. And so the fabric of space-time can move at any speed you like. When the universe started up, it expanded at thousands of times faster than the speed of light, and if it had not done so, the entire universe today would be smaller than the dot on the letter I on the printed page. So it's called the Alcubierre effect, A-L-C-U-B-I-E-R-R-E. I apologise for my very bad French pronunciation. And so you can shrink the space in front of you, expand the space behind you, and then arrive there earlier. There is one minor problem, that when you begin to arrive at this location, that you are putting out more energy than all of the stars in the universe put together, and that you apply this energy to your target, which then gets vaporized. Minor technical problem, we're working around it, or maybe you can find a better theory whereby we can bypass that, maybe, Dante.
Okay.
Cool. Good on you, Dante. Thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Carr.
Dylan Alcott here with you on Triple J on your Thursday morning, joined with Dr. Carl. Getting straight back to the questions. Jason in the Northern Beaches of New South Wales, what's your question, mate?
Yo, good morning, doctors. What's happening, Dr. Carl? Respect.
Get on you, Jason. How are you, my man?
Basically, Dr. Carl, I just want to ask you about the pineal gland in the brain and whether you think that when it produces the DMT, when we're born and when we die, if that is the secret to where we go at the end of our life and what you think about it.
Ah, the pineal gland was first noted by a polymath, which is a fancy word meaning somebody who knows a lot about a lot of different things.
Yes.
The guy called René Descartes, who was a mathematician. And so if you've heard of Cartesian geometry at high school, he was that guy. He was also a bit of an anatomist and also a mathematician. And he was the one who came out with that clever phrase, which is, I think, therefore I am. And the modern version of that is, if you're a scientist, I think, therefore I get paid. With regard to the pineal gland, it's a centerline organ in the brain that is not paired. There's not two of them. There's just one on the center line. And we know that it is involved deeply with your sleep-awake cycles with regard to putting out melatonin. And so with regard to jet lag, loss of sleep as you get older, why the, for example, the teenagers, as soon as they hit puberty, why do they need 10 hours sleep instead of 8? And furthermore, why they do not get tired until 11 o'clock at night is not because they are evil, but it's their pineal gland producing the melatonin later and changing its rhythms. So with regard to it being the seat of consciousness, we still don't know where that is. People thought about that for a long time, and we still don't know where consciousness is. With regard to putting out DMT, I have not read of that. And Jason, you have given me some homework. Thank you very much for increasing my workload, but in the long term, I'll appreciate it.
Yeah, you make sure you read up on it, Dr. Carl. One day, me and you'll get together. We'll have a big fat reefer, and we'll have a talk about it because it's the truth.
Good on you, Jason. See you, mate. Hey, we got Paul in Canberra. Paul, what's your question,
mate? I'm just wondering where all the poo goes.
Where all the poo goes?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that it gets broken down, and just we've got billions of animals.
Yeah,
billions of people. Now, everybody takes a dump sometime during the day. And I know the bacteria break it down, but where does it go then?
Basically, it gets recycled and then gets turned back into you and me. Now, there has been some recent research that wrongly claimed in the media that all animals poop in 12 seconds. What? A 20-gram mouse and a 7-ton elephant take exactly 12 seconds to squirt it out? No. So what they meant was that two-thirds of animals do it between... So two-thirds of animals do it between about 5 and 20 seconds. There's a wonderful paper on it called The Hydrodynamics of Defecation, published by the Royal Society of Chemistry, which is really a very reputable source, and one of their journals with a rather coy and engaging name of Soft Matter. And this deals with how long it takes to come out. But where it goes, basically it gets recycled. So each time you have a glass of water... Each time you have a breath, you are taking in molecules of water that were breathed in and breathed out by a dinosaur, Adolf Hitler, Jesus Christ, Buddha, Muhammad. They all get recycled. And poo just goes around and around and it gets recycled because it's got all that good nitrogen in it. It's a shame to let it go waste. Trouble is that in parts of China, when they're using it at the early stage, if it already has the hepatitis A virus in it and they don't process it, the hepatitis A virus survives, makes it from the poo into the fields, into the berries, then gets frozen in 2015, and now there's yet our second outbreak of hepatitis A from frozen berries from China. So that's kind of proof that basically it all gets recycled and turns into you. Just avoid those berries. You'll be cool.
And no worries. Thanks, man.
Good on you, Paul. Thanks, mate. We're now joined by Nick in Minnow. Nick, what's your question?
Hi. I'm just wondering, in the good old days, before there was electricity and pumps, how fountains worked, how they managed to spray water everywhere.
The Romans and the Greeks were masters of the aqueducts, especially the Romans. And so with a very delicate fall of so many centimetres per kilometre, they could run water kilometres, tens of kilometres and hundreds of kilometres. And so if you go to Rome, you can still see these aqueducts, and they're basically an open, sometimes closed, stone channel, 5, 10, 15, 30, 50 metres high, jumping across a valley. And this is carrying the water. And it's all been planned by these amazing engineers 2,000 years ago, and it's all powered by gravity and ultimately comes back to the water that has been turned into snow in the hills, and they've brought the water from hundreds of kilometres away, always coming downhill. So the answer is they did it with gravity.
Cool. Good on you, Nick.
There you go.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
On Triple J, you were Dylan Alcott, filling in for Zan Rowe, who is on holidays, also joined by Dr. Carl. And we've got Michelle in Niagara Park. Michelle, what's your question?
Why do redheads have problems with anaesthetics?
Oh, okay. So firstly, with regard to redheads, they are different from people who are not redheads because they have a different expression in their DNA of how they work with a gene called MCR, melanocortin receptor gene, MCR, melanocortin receptor gene, which not just creates red hair, but also codes for parts of the nervous system and then is involved with melanin, which we mentioned a little while ago, and then that's also involved in your daily sleep. So you'd think sleep anesthetic, maybe. So what we've got is a situation socially where these people who, with a stereotype that includes that they have a fiery temper, they are now accused of being a troublemaker even when they're on sleep. Oh, my God. So there was a survey. There was a study about 10, 15 years ago with, wait for it, 10 healthy young volunteers. Not 1,000, not 100, 10. And it did show that the people who had red hair were more resistant to anesthesia and also therefore more likely to experience being aware while they should have been asleep during the surgical procedure. But yeah. Professor Miles, in 2012, from the Alfred Hospital and Monash University in Australia, did a large study of 486. Now, that's not as good as 4,000, but 400, that is much better than 10. And he found that there was no difference.
Mm, cool. Okay. Good on you, Michelle. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
That's us done for Science Hour of this week. Dr. Carl, thanks for joining us, mate. I hope your knee feels a bit better.
I'm hanging on. Luckily, we've got a good medical system in Australia, which is still cheap, and I'm hanging on out on using it this afternoon.
Good on you, Dr. Carr. We'll see you the same time next week.
Catch you then.